My name is Woody Brown, and this is a recording of my story, Silly Head. So, you know, imagine this is one of your formative memories. Your dad takes you to soccer practice in Delaware Park in his maroon city-issued Crown Vic. And you, being you, hate it, of course. You don't like the fact that you're so young they put girls and boys on the same team. That practice starts when you would otherwise be resting and thinking small you thoughts and conversing with Matthias, the fictional mouse friend you made up one day while sitting in your seat on the 214 cheese bus because the bus aide Betty made you turn off your father's Walkman and Queen cassette, both of which he lent you because, in his words, he loves you, because she said it was electronic paraphernalia, and for that reason and because so many shows Mom lets you watch before bed and books from your father mention kids with imaginary friends and because you figure you're still young enough that it'd be mostly excusable to talk to yourself, you have made yourself an imaginary friend. And anyway, you might be talking to Matthias, the sword-carrying gray mouse, and doing whatever else it is that you do that so keeps your mind in such an endearing state of bluster and wonder. But the bottom line is, all of this is made impossible by those strange and enigmatic hands that move the clouds above your curly head, and the sun behind them, and the perfect little hour-long blocks of time that comprise your unknowable little kid day. Your father takes you because your mother says loudly one night that you're fat. She sits you down the next day and takes out one of the Naugahyde-bound photo albums that line the lower shelves in the living room, and she makes you sit there while she looks through the big book for every picture of you in which you made the mistake of showing a round, flushed cheek or a pale section of your little uncooked dough belly, and piles them on the table, and you sit and think about your little things like kingdoms and people who can cast spells and swords and stuff, and she says she's going to tear up these hideous pictures of you, and ever true to her word, she does right then and there. You're too young to lament her summary destruction of these little mementos, but you cry nonetheless because you know this all signifies a big change in your life, and you feel the first fledgling flutter of nostalgia's turbid and dark and feathered wing. By around age 13, you will know the whole bird intimately. You never thought you were particularly fat, but then again, you guess it all depends on who you're being compared to. A lot of your friends are more like classmates, seem built almost identically to you, though there are, of course, those strange skinny ones who think it's fun to whip people with towels after gym and who have somehow had sculpted six-packs since they were restless and hyperactive toddlers with an interest in optics only insofar as it facilitated the ritual holocaust of ants and other exoskeletal miniatures that you, conversely, kept in a flat, book-width terrarium that billed itself as a farm, but which farm never proved fecund except olfactorily. And in any case, who was your mother to say? What with her compulsive habits of yo-yo dieting and imposing seemingly absurd gastronomical restrictions on her couch-bound body, cf. the strange summer during which she was hell-bent on eliminating all vitamin C from her system, and her ballooning and shrinking mercurial soma. And though you reproach yourself for it, you think who knows fat better than she, and you grin inside your head with Matthias because neither of you can find an answer to that question. So soccer is the sport because you find yourself unwilling to mill around shirtless as you would probably have to if you chose to join the swim team. But you're not exactly confident in your ability to run around all day and all that, which lack of confidence is probably due in part to your mother's again quite loud proclamation to your father that your weak bones will probably break under the flabby inertia of the roiling sea of lapidified disuse that is your torso and environs, though it's probably pretty clear that I augmented that a little bit. And that night, the night before your first practice, the whole traumatic process of insult and accusation having been carefully timed by your usually immobile mother to coincide with the immediate start of the fall soccer season in Delaware Park, which opening day your father discovered when he phoned his old friend, your new coach, to ask if you might receive a spot on his crack team of boys, which spot was immediately granted not by virtue of the ringing steel timbre of the bond between your father and your soon-to-be coach, but because your father had recently performed a fine bit of lawyering, the end result of which being that your soon-to-be coach somehow did not end up serving jail time for his sixth DWI in the last year. On this night, before joining the crack team of towel-whipping, six-pack-having, ADHD-diagnosed squirrely boys, you cannot for the life of you fall asleep. Matthias snores audibly, taunting you in his catatonia. Dim blue glow of twilight and cigarette smoke clouds through translucent linen curtains. The sad Doppler-affected crackle and ragtime of the Mr. Softy truck warbling its way pigeon-wheeled and barely dairy down the street. So you lie in bed and you don't recall falling asleep, or rather you feel as if there was no border crossed between consciousness and sleep when you have a strange dream that you will still be able to recall years hence. You rise from your bed into the blurred blue and gray, and you look around the room. Your feet feel distinctly the scratch of the blue clotted shag carpet that covers the floor of your room, and you recall thinking within the half-dream that Stanley Steamer could do a useful number on the ragged rug. A continent of fabric that probably hadn't been given a well-deserved deep clean since it was trampled by the former owner and his friends and doused in thin lager beer and dip spit. You stand, or so you think, and you see the translucent overlay of a NASCAR racetrack as if from above, and you use your half-dream, eagle-eyed ability to magnify the situation, and you zero in on a car, a sort of top-down, cartoonish convertible in which you sit at the wheel and your father sits behind you, cheering and waving his gangling arms. And then, in a strange development that convinces you in retrospect that it all must have been a dream, rather than a sort of lucid product of the same obviously quite extraordinary imagination that produced Matthias and the aforementioned snippet of conversation with that knighted mouse, you find yourself whipping a yo-yo around the world, well, around the racetrack, in the generally circular pattern flawed with crooked turns and hairpin bottlenecks, a yellow yo-yo with a thin string that makes your only slightly chubby middle finger purple. You feel suddenly that you have begun to cry out of your elbow. You clutch that elbow, your right elbow, to your heaving chest, and you shiver with the violent sobs of your elbow's queer and unsurprising tear ducts. The tears travel up your arms and into your neck, and with a sucking sound, they crawl into the crusty corners of your eyeballs. You hear a pounding in the floorboards, the trotting canter of many rubber-soled shoes, the meaty fists of the old owner and his friends in the floorboards armed with bent bottle caps and pocket knives, the tools they used to carve P was here, J&M, drinking with ha-ha written over it, Timmy O, into the banister of the creaky stairwell of your house. You think that they are the petrified, loud voices of a youth now supplanted by old age. You are imaginative. You hear them scraping. Your mother slaps you in the face, and you are in the warm light of the house's kitchen, and you feel far more afraid than you were because of the dinner plate size of your mother's bloodshot eyeballs. She says often and loudly that you should reconsider your decision to shake and mumble and grip your right elbow like a, quote, palsied savant. She says you really should get a grip. She says get a grip. So again, you are in the Crown Vic the day after all this, and you're quietly lamenting some vague new absence you feel on the right side of your chest, this, of course, being well before you learn that your heart in its pericardiac womb is located above your diaphragm on the left side of your chest, and you feel a sharp, in your words, debilitating pain in your right shoulder, this, of course, being after you learn that heart attacks give themselves away with debilitating shoulder pain when you saw the dad on That 70s Show have a heart attack on TV. Your palms begin to sweat on the maroon leather handle on the ceiling of the car that some genius decided to put there, you guess, for if the driver is just really bad and scary. You look at your father. He traces his finger around the rim of the tumbler of amber, quote, sauce in the cup holder between your two seats, and as he does that, he exhales smoke from his cigarette through his nostrils, like the dragon in the final picture in your illustrated copy of The Hobbit, an ancient hardcover copy that, like most things you own, came from your father, and which book the Czech exchange student named Vitek, your mother had the clever idea of hosting for 6 months. Vitek was later expelled from your house by the same mother that invited him there for the fatal mistake of eating peanut butter out of the jar with two fingers, licking said fingers clean, and then reintroducing them into the jar repeatedly, and according to your mother, he did so with little to no remorse in full view of your mother, who was apparently so repulsed by this practice that she stood behind him in front of the light blue glow of the computer screen and tapped her foot while that same night he booked a flight back to Prague. The point is, Vitek used to read the book, and he left dirty finger smudges on the nicest illustrations, which felt to you like a slap in the face to your father. But so your mother, 15 minutes after making him book a flight, made you a peanut butter sandwich with the salivated stuff. You, of course, had no way of knowing about the tainted nature of your sandwich, being the trusting and otherwise occupied child you are, and packed it in a brown paper bag with an expired juice box-sized carton of chocolate milk, the straw to which carton was later found by you to be missing, and to have left behind only its plastic wrapping glued to the carton like a spent condom, and a greasy Ziploc bag of crushed potato chips, and sent you off to school the following morning with the bag, and a why didn't you get up when you heard me yell your name, Spank, to start your day. So you're having what you're almost positive is an actual heart attack, and you're thinking to yourself, can I get a witness here? But you know, if you tell your father, he'll ask you to kindly refrain from being such a drama queen, and truth be told, we all know there's no way you're having a heart attack. But of course, that doesn't change the obviously significant pains in your body. The pain is real, right? And if it's not a heart attack, then what is it? But then, of course, you admit to your father, in your, note, entirely imagined, dialogue with him, that he's right, and you swear you'd stop hurting if you could, but you feel like some cruel god has cursed you with an extreme sensitivity to discomfort and pain, and you mentioned to him, again, in your head, that this ability could prove useful in that it could signal a serious injury or a condition well before modern medical technology might be able to detect it. Dad. Dad, this is legit. You promise this is not just you being a, quote, manic weirdo. You promise, Dad. And after all, what about whatever the hell happened last night, Dad? Doesn't he know you and he raced around the track in, like, a father-son sort of race car thing? The car is silent. So your dad pulls up to the park and does that thing that everyone else seems to think it's okay to do, where they park their cars half on the grass and half on the street, like their children's memberships in a free afternoon soccer league makes it all right for them to trash the edges of a park designed by Frank Lloyd Wright. And there's a baseball diamond, and you see, like a speck in the sky, a baseball come hurtling like a furious wingless cherub from heaven right through the passenger side of the windshield of your father's city-issue 1987 Ford Crown Victoria. You and your father turn to stare at the perfectly spherical hole in the glass, and you notice the baseball is stuck between the headrest and the lower part of the passenger seat at the exact location where the top of your curly head was whipping itself into a hardly attacked frenzy something like 30 seconds before. Your father walks to the car to retrieve his three fingers of tequila from the cup holder and drains it after fishing a shard of glass out of the tumbler. And then he has a revelation where you can almost see the little light bulb go on above his, at this point, probably fuzzy head, and he places the empty glass in the hole in the windshield and it somehow fits perfectly. Alcoholic ingenuity, you think. Again, this is more me than you. You feel more and more nervous as you walk toward the soccer field with the most orange-shirted U14s. You feel suddenly a strong urge to urinate, which you do in small, intentionally invisible bursts because you know your black athletic shorts are black, that you recognize with dread and, strangely, a little bit of satisfaction, that your mother will find her attempt to do the laundry like a, quote, house nigger, her words, interrupted by the yellow stain on your white underwear, which underwear the aforementioned squirrely crew crut unibombers in the making refer to embarrassingly as tidy whities. And then will avenge your petty robbery of her time by interrupting your attempt to do your Spanish homework while listening to your father's Warren Zevon cassette with that very silly recording of Ico Ico on it, the original recording of which song by the Dixie Cups your father informs you every time he plays the song in his city issue Ford Crown Victoria features the actual sound of actual spoons on actual Coke bottles, and will brandish the underwear and throw it in your face in what you think is a sort of funny reversal of the classic rub the dog's face in its own to teach it a lesson method of teaching a lesson. What with the feces coming to the face of the dog in this case. And then she will ask you who said you could listen to tunes while you do your schoolwork, and then will take the cassette out of the little plastic stereo and crush it with the calloused bunion on her bare right foot. Though, of course, you can only look slyly forward to the first part, as the second, the whole thing about the broken cassette, will come as a bit of a surprise to you, to say the absolute least. Your wet underwear irritates the inside of your pudgy thighs. Your now no longer soon-to-be coach lines you all up, turns out it is a co-ed team, and says your team name is Agent Orange, and you hear chuckles, some quiet, and some half-past guffaws from the sparse crowd of awkward parents standing, the fatter have pulled flimsy lawn chairs out of thin air and chosen to sit in them, on the sideline. You do not get it. You feel often that you do not get things, and you are convinced that if you could understand the unfathomably wise and subtle humor of your parents' world, you would be a king among kids, though of course you consider it that you might just wait until you're old enough that you exist in that lukewarm fish tank of small jokes and cigarettes and red faces without knowing it. But then you feel it would be nowhere near as cool, and you have what is for you a revelation that you really only like to want things, and that when you get them you are bored and sweat springs from your palms when you think for a brief horrible moment that this may be the structure of everything. Matthias recommends that you get something resembling a grip, and then you see your penny-clothed compatriots running past you, and you run along with them until you see your father throw his hands in the air on the sideline, and you realize that the coach had separated the boys and girls, and you had elected to run with the girls. Had your mother been doing something besides grinning to herself sprawled on the living room couch, i.e., watching you at your first practice, you think she would have definitely yelled something mean to you or something like that or whatever. Your father mercifully stays silent. You get winded on the jog back to where your team had gathered around your coach in the first place, and you begin during said jog the mental tally of how many steps you ran during practice that day. A chubby, pale kid who is taller than you, whose name you do not know, but whose name I know is Campbell, juts his chin out and blows air upward to get his messy hair out of his eyes, and you think he looks exactly like an old English sheepdog, a picture of which dog is on the cover of one of your favorite books, a book your father gave you for Christmas about how dogs have the ability to love, called, appropriately and vaguely bestiality-ly, Dog Love, Yes, It's Real, by David Harrelson, Houghton Mifflin Co., 1988, a man whose name has the same distinctive pen name, Stink, as Clive Hamilton, the pseudonym of author C.S. Lewis, the one line written by which author you recall being, "Look, a marvel," from one of the Narnia books, because you thought for a couple months that you had discovered one of the more embarrassing typographical errors in recent memory, until your father informed you that no, the author was not in fact trying to spell the word marvel. Campbell, whose name you do not know, spits. You cannot help yourself from gagging when you hear or see somebody hack up a loogie and spit, just as you are so nauseated by the thought of the possibility of inhaling the moist expulsion of gastrointestinal stench that people typically call burps, that when you are within ear or eyeshot of a belching offender, you cover your nose and mouth with the collar of your shirt for no fewer than 3 seconds. In this case, being no exception, you gag and feel the hot, acidic bile singe the back of your throat and whatever tube it is that leads to your nose. Your teammates begin kicking balls around, and you go to return an impossibly fast lob, only to find yourself promptly seated and bewildered on the grass with the hot salt of tears welling in your eyeballs. Your cheeks explode in embarrassment. You wonder why it is that humans have yet to develop a mechanism with which they might control that understated but instantly revealing blush, that cheek-wise betrayal of one's true feelings that is so rude it doesn't even bother to ask the ego if it can rear its blotchy head. You look to the sideline and see that your father is absent, or at least no longer where he was. You think this is no cause for alarm. You just wonder where he went, you know, just because, whatever, he's your dad. His former post is now occupied by a stereotype. A fat white man in white too-short shorts and a Hawaiian t-shirt sitting in a lawn chair with an ingenious little holder for a miniature umbrella at the top. Some guy patented that, you think. Campbell, whose name you do not know, will be the goalie. Two buzz-cut little rubber bands will be the defense, and you and two other kids who are so unessential to the plot of the story and who, if I were to describe them, would appear so unbelievably two-dimensional and lame that you would think I had really let you down at this point as narrator and fabricator, serve as the offense. Boys v. girls. You wonder why your ex-almost coach would choose such a lopsided arrangement. A pimpled, braced teenager with gel in his hair and a black and white uniform on, to you and your teammates, an elder of such stature and wisdom that he is secondary in terms of respect only to the temporally complicated coach, himself only bested by the constantly challenged but never ever weakened wherewithal and sagacity of mom and dad, divorce being a fact of life for a grand, statistically improbable total of one of you, Axel Drexel, a poor kid everyone knows was named in some illegally induced high or, more believably, low, a culinarily inclined kid who got in real trouble one day when he made his own lunch to bring to school, his parents having been up late the night before brewing up a particularly potent fertilizer for the small but growing crop of hydroponic weed in their attic, which fertilizer they gave the clever name Lexard's Luau Laughing Hash, and packed a dime bag of what he thought was oregano to sprinkle tableside on his Triscuits and diced tomatoes to make what he calls bruschetta, the name of which elegant dish he insists on pronouncing in his words, the correct Italian way, with the hard k, like bruschetta. Anyway, the teenager with the gel and ref's uniform drops a ball at your feet with such palpable lethargy, you start firing synapses toward feeling offended, but you find yourself interrupted by the unbreakable barrier of the shin guard of the girls' team's forward, Maggie McCaffrey, that vile harlot, as it forces its way between your buckled knees and straight into your hesitantly descending testicles, testicles that, if they had some sort of memory or brain, would have made a testicle pact to stay hidden in the okay kind of flabby security of your abdomen for the next decade or two. You fall. You see the dark green of the back of your father's polo shirt turned toward you, his bald spot keeping watch while he converses with a smiling blonde woman. You let out a shrill shout. Your father does not turn, but Campbell laughs so uncontrollably at your testicular misfortune that as you see out of the corner of your eye, he is forced to steady his nothing-special shivering body against the goalpost. Your coach calls your name, and you shout in a quivering voice, perhaps altered maybe just a little bit to produce maximum dramatic effect. What? He says, "Come here, damn it, I'm benching you." As you waddle toward him clutching your crotch, you think it would be pretty funny if he meant he was going to bench press you. Like, you know how people say, "I bench 200 or whatever. Just a little pun that occurs to you. Just a little whatever. As you sit on the grass at the sideline opposite your father's sometime vacant post, because there is no actual bench, just the ground, you try to come to terms with the profound, life-altering trauma of having your recently delineated erogenous zone invaded, you think, raped, by Maggie McCaffrey's Adidas shin guard, a piece of phallic plastic probably purchased at Dick's, you know, in keeping with the whole phallus thing. You give up on the rape narrative. Your eyes uncross and you see across the field your father holding the hand of the sparkly-eyed blonde woman, a girl, really, as they walk toward your father's city-issue maroon 1987 Ford Crown Victoria. You think, You call, Dad. He does not hear. Your blah-blah-blah coach tells you, shut up, you. You think you really don't like soccer practice, but you gave it the old kindergarten try, and you think, who can blame you for wanting to jump ship? And jump ship you do. You run right across the field, the site of the testicular trauma and the scene of, as the reader will recall, a still-in-progress game of gender bias soccer, ignoring the curiously quiet pleas for you to reconsider and stay with the team, i.e., no one was calling after you at all, really, running to your father, who at this point is halfway in the car, and whose female companion is fully seated and buckled and prepared for liftoff, running until you see her lithe, pale hand crawl up the right leg of your father's 32-34 Levi's and grasp what would be, on you, the post-testicular crater created by the forceful invasion of Maggie McCaffrey's Adidas shin guard purchased at Dick's Sporting Goods, at which point you accidentally, without meaning to at all, completely unintentionally trip and fall. Somehow, right on your extended index and middle fingers, which fingers force themselves, of their own gravitational accord, into the back of your throat, and which back of the throat convulses with your infamous gag reflex, the bane of so many pediatricians' tongue depressors in gloved hands and lab coats, such that you find yourself vomiting uncontrollably on the admittedly quite well-maintained golf course that borders the soccer field site of the pulverization of your genitals for what seems like far too long until you look up and see a wisp of blonde hair exit stage left and your father walking towards you saying, hush, for Christ's sake, what's the problem? You can throw up, sure, but why the damn hell do you have to moan like that? Get in the car, you're making a scene.
With us today is Woody Brown, fiction writer and literary reviewer for Art Voice, Western New York's largest weekly newspaper. Welcome, Woody.
Hi.
We just heard you read your story, Silly Head. What scary mother in that story? Do you know of a woman who sat her child down and made him watch as she burned pictures of him from when he was fat?
Of course I do. Do you think I just made up something that's sadistic on my own?
I wasn't sure.
Well, let me verify it. Of course, I know that person, although it doesn't really matter for the purposes of the story whether she's real or not.
Okay. So, next question.
Sure.
What is interesting about this story's narrative perspective is how the narrator's younger self, the protagonist, is shown to be innocent, deeply harassed, and helpless. He evokes the little kid from the movie Bad Santa, if you know what I'm talking about, while the narrator's older self, who is telling the story, brings redemption and strength to his younger self character by rendering his harassers as simpletons through tunnel condescension. For example, there's the scene where the father fixes the hole in his windshield by placing a tumbler in it, where you write, you can almost see the light bulb go on above his, at this point, probably fuzzy head. How did you choose this perspective?
Well, first off, you said that the narrator is discussing his younger self, which, you know, I don't think is implied in the story. I wrote it in the second person, which is a weird place to write from, at least uncommon. Because I wanted to make it so that the emotive address of the story was familiar, as if the narrator was speaking to you, which is why it's written so that the narrator is literally speaking to the reader. I guess the phrase would be implicating the reader, because the narrator is literally forcing the reader to imagine that these things have happened to him or herself. It is not correct that the character in the story, the hapless little kid, is the narrator's younger self at all.
I just took that to be true. I assumed it.
It's not like the biggest deal in the entire world, and certainly anybody's interpretation finds that's great. But the way that I wrote it, at least from my point of view, which is just about as valid as yours, the story is entirely fictional, and it's written in the second person, so that the motive address is more familiar than an omniscient third-person narrative. I was thinking a lot about a sort of narrative style, a narrative voice that's really common in Russian literature called skaz.
Skaz?
Skaz. Skaz, S-K-A-Z, in the NAR alphabet, and Cyrillic, it's different letters, and I don't speak Russian or read Cyrillic, so I don't really know what those letters are. Skaz is a way of telling a story that will be like an omniscient third-person narrator that's sometimes inflected in a weird and familiar way, you know, so-and-so walked down the street, but with weird notes of familiarity, constant references to other people, to the townsfolk. Dostoevsky uses it a lot. It's all over the Brothers Karamazov, for instance, so be one very easy example to look at, the first chapter. That was sort of what I had in mind, but I wanted to employ that sort of conversational mode of address in all of my fiction, and one of the ways I found that I could do that was in using this sort of second-person voice.
That makes sense. I think the reason why I assumed it was an older version of the character addressing his younger self was the older character had such sympathy for the younger character, and I felt like he was reflecting on that pain as if it were his own.
Yeah, it's not really the most random, insane thing I've ever heard, in fact, it makes sense. It's more like the story begins off. So, you know, imagine this happening, okay? And when somebody talks to you like that, if I say to you, so, Nicholas, imagine this. So you're walking down the street, you know, you would assume that I was telling you a story about myself, right? This is why I wrote it this way, because that's how people sound when they tell stories. Like, what is the voice that's most comfortable or most appropriate for me to use to address the reader? And my interest is primarily in telling stories, so I chose a voice that is exactly what people sound like when they tell stories, except significantly more, let's say, loquacious.
Well, I did enjoy the tone. I thought it was very maximalist, the way you wrote the story, with little kids' actions and thoughts, but in this really elegant and complex language. I don't have the story in front of me, but I remember there were a lot of sentences that were jam-packed with a lot of details and humor.
I will say, this was my thing. I had a fiction teacher named Alex Cheek, who is the author of, among other things, the novel Edinburgh, and he, in our workshop, was constantly stressing that explaining your story is never good. If you feel like there are things you need to explain in your story, then your story is not complete. You know, there should be no necessity for the author aid the reader outside of what's written.
Okay.
Hopefully this won't ruin the story, and if it does, then thanks for nothing. I wrote this story to be essentially about the genesis of the symptom. Okay? So you start, you know, the roughest outline of the story. Step one, picture a kid throwing up. Step two, the kid makes himself puke. Okay?
That's pretty funny. And all the stuff in between was just you filling in the gaps?
More like I wanted the connection between the originary event and the resultant symptom. Okay? This is a loaded, loaded term, but let's just call it the hint of the beginning of an eating disorder. I wanted the connection between those two things to be totally obscured by what the story is actually made of, which is the stuff of life, the insane, multitudinous details, weird minutiae that are only barely relevant. I mean, the thing about, for instance, the Czech exchange student that is relevant, certainly not to the plot, because that's really sort of what life is like, you know? We act in a certain way and do certain things. Often we know not what we do. And they have their roots in things, and their roots are certainly not in your genes. But so much language, so many words, so much sort of life tends to obscure the connection between the two. Such that we walk around wondering, you know, why every night we make ourselves puke after eating or something, or why we, you know, have to turn a light on and off 10 times before we exit a room or anything, or even more mild things that aren't assigned names in the DSM-4. So, I really did intend to show what one person's experience of the genesis of the symptom was.
That's really cool. You unite two different things and really just have to come up with what comes between them.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted the story to be, let's say, realistic in a certain sense. So say that I wanted to write a story that was all about how horrible eating disorders are. The story certainly wouldn't be very good, because I would go into it with a pretty political agenda and a message to send, and messages aren't always bad. My primary concern is always writing something that succeeds as fiction, without just being my mouthpiece for my opinions on different issues. And fiction is, I think, always primarily about people, and that's because people are fascinating. And so, yeah, my intellectual interests, which primarily involve psychoanalysis and words like genesis and symptom, those are relevant, sort of. They're just more highfalutin ways to talk about what is primarily, I think, a human story and what it's like to be a person who grows up with parents who are a certain way and finds himself acting in other ways that he doesn't immediately understand.
Yeah, it's really funny. While you were speaking, what you told me plainly earlier clicked in, that the story is about an eating disorder? The reason I was unable to understand that until I just had my little epiphany was because when he throws up, he trips and then falls on his finger, which is really, his finger jams down his mouth, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is really unlikely and funny.
I actually have it in front of me. Let me find it. Okay, here we go. At this point, you accidentally, without meaning to at all, completely unintentionally, trip and fall, somehow, right on your extended index and middle fingers, which fingers force themselves of their own gravitational accord into the back of your throat.
That's a really funny way of getting that across, especially with the beginning, to let you understand that he's got problems with the weight and the mother. But I got lost by the time I got to him tripping on his fingers, so that I was just reading that as you describing him tripping on his finger in an interesting and rhythmic way, and I did not read into it at all. So that's really funny.
Yeah, I mean, I wrote it to sound like I was protesting too much, you know, like completely accidentally, totally unintentionally, you know. The narrator the entire time is, for lack of a better word, messing around and making jokes, making weird little side comments, pointing out whether or not what a character is doing seems genuine or if they might have others' intentions behind them. And there, his constant repetition of how totally unintentional and random it was a sign that, of course, it was not at all unintentional or random, and in fact, eagerly intended and anticipated. That's the whole thing. People always do things and seem utterly stunned by what they do. Why does this keep happening to me? How come I do this? And I guess it is sort of a funny human joke that what may be readily apparent to everybody around somebody is totally obscure to the subject himself.
I still can't believe that I didn't figure that out before. That's really cool now that I understand.
Maybe I didn't do something right. Maybe I screwed up. But then, at the same time, okay, I'm going to try and stay consistent here. What I just said a couple minutes ago was that what I was trying to do was obscure the connection between the originary event and the final expression of the symptom. And that's literally what I did, and that you didn't connect the dots, because I put so much stuff in between designed to look like the linguistic equivalent of flashing neon lights.
Now that you say that, I don't think I made that connection, because what really wowed me the most about this story were some of the really funny, unlikely things that happened that I actually categorized him tripping and falling on his finger and throwing up as an unlikely thing, even though it's just a smart way and a subtle way to say something that is likely. For instance, the tumbler in the window. That's really unlikely that a baseball would go through a window and then somebody would think to put a tumbler in the little slot. I guess the mother writing the picture is still a little over the top to me, not to the point where I didn't want to believe the story, but to the point where it was surprising and exciting. I was always waiting for the next strange thing to happen.
Sure. You know, there's a lot of weird stuff that happens in this story. Things that are improbable, unbelievable, totally strange. I mean, I spent at least 2 double-spaced pages talking about his hallucination, the whole thing about his crying out of his elbow. At the most basic level, people see really strange things, and I was never really concerned with the question of what are the chances of the tumbler being able to fit exactly in the hole in the window, because the whole point is it's a totally absurd, and what are the chances of anything? He was in the car, but then a baseball hurtles through the front windshield, but I mean, in any case, if it's safety glass designed to break in a different way, not leave a perfectly spherical hole, I mean, that's totally impossible. Lots of stuff in the story is not really something that would have happened. But, I mean, it's there because I think, one, it's interesting, two, it's sort of funny, and three, it all kind of adds to what I wanted to be a sort of technicolor picture of somebody's weird life. All the stuff about VTech, all the different words, I put so many different words in there because I wanted it to be sort of stunning in that way, something that commands your attention as loud, verbose, and fun to read.
I really enjoy those qualities of stories, absurd and unexpected things that are also really bizarre. I remember reading a story by Wells Power. This slug ended up killing all the other fish in this fish tank. And by the time this happens, it's really symbolic. And so then the guy throws the whole fish tank on the living room floor and the water floods everywhere. It's just really weird. Just like the tumbler and the window shield, it does carry symbolic weight, but it's also very unique. I don't know if there's another story that has had that in it.
Yeah, but I mean, okay, so Nicholas, let's be good readers and think about what sort of symbolism we may be able to read into that gesture. I actually don't want to think about that at all because I wrote the story. But, you know, anybody could read anything into that that they want. So the hole being plugged by a tumbler that's exactly the right size, well, you could say the hole in the dash life is similar. did in the story is fixated on that hole because he thinks that only if he's exactly the right size will he be able to be the desired object that can fill the other's lack. Anything. It's a metaphor for anything because it's a metaphor for nothing at the same time.
Can you tell me a little bit about your novel, Jump Ship?
Jump Ship is my undergraduate thesis. I know it is or was. I mean, it still is my undergraduate thesis, but I handed it in a year and a half ago, which is depressing to think about how long it's been and how little I've done since then. But, yeah, I received approval from the Amherst College Department of English to write a novel for my thesis for Latin honors, which I then did. And I had been working on the stories of the family. That's one of the big subjects of the book, this family. I had been working on them for, let's say, 4 or 5 months before September 2010, when I officially began work on a novel with my advisor, Judith Frank. And yeah, I turned in the manuscript in, April 19, 2011, and it was, I think, 230 pages long. It was certainly the biggest project I've ever worked on and the hardest I've worked on a single project ever. And yeah, that's it. Now it languishes in my hard drive, gathering cyber dust.
Do you think you're going to do anything with it?
It's difficult. It's difficult to say because I spent so much of my time and mind writing the stories of the people that are in the novel. And then that was that. You know, it's like the issue with anything that really happens at school. You're not supposed to really write it for approval from, you know, the department, from professors you respect. You're supposed to write it to be the best novel that it can be so that it's successful fiction. But, you know, the weirdness of that is that at the end of the day, I still handed it in to the department, and they still chose whether or not to give me Latin honors for it. So, okay, so it's done. And there are things I would definitely change about it and things that I still have to change, but it's been very difficult to bring myself to revisit it. Just, you know, in the same way that it was difficult to get over leaving Amherst, and the same way it's difficult to get over an ex-girlfriend.
Yeah, I imagine it would be not an inviting task. I want to go back and try and perfect the novel, especially if it's almost 300 pages.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, I know other people's work better than I know my own. The novel itself is structured in a really strange way and features like 8 or 9 main characters. And all of their stories interact in ways that are kind of ornate and basically very difficult to keep track of if you go into the novel with the aim of changing it. Because changing one thing could throw into crisis something 150 pages down the line. And so that was another thing. It was so daunting to look at it again because I'd put it out of my head and forgotten things, which is weird because I wrote them, you know, like, how could I forget about these people that I was totally obsessed with?
When you were reading a book to review it for Art Voice, what positive or negative qualities are you most watchful for?
I don't know. I mean, okay, if you actually sit down and read my reviews, like all of them, you will find that, I don't know, there's not that many, there's like 7 or something. You'll find that they are, let's say, generally negative. And the things that I'm positive about tend to be older things, which is not the way I want it to be. It's a very sweet gig I have. I obviously just, you know, write to a publishing house and I ask for a review copy and they send me a review copy. And I love reading. And a lot of the time I'll request books by people that I already sort of liked, anticipating something great. But, I don't know, let's be real. I'm not beholden to anybody about this stuff. My editor just wants me to write what I want to write. And I don't like know any of these authors personally, so maybe that makes me more critical or something. But the bottom line is, with some of the stuff I've reviewed, if I had written that and submitted it to a professor, they would have given me a bad grade. You know, not my reviews, any of these books. Like, for instance, Jonathan Franzen's collection of essays was, I mean, I just don't understand how somebody could write that and get that published. It's one of those things that I think lots of writers feel where when they read something that's been published that they don't really like, they think, this guy got this published, but I can't get my novel published, which is, you know, one, totally embarrassing and narcissistic, and two, obviously inflected by my own perceptions of my self-worth. But let's be real about it, right? I'm being totally honest. The Jonathan Franzen question essay called Farther Away was completely phoned in and dumb and utterly embarrassing. Who's another guy I reviewed? Dave Eggers. Yeah, Dave Eggers. This is his most recent novel called A Hologram for the King, released, I think, about a month ago. And it was like, I mean, I don't understand how somebody could write that and call it a novel, because his concerns, if an author's concerns don't seem to be with the fiction itself, then I usually find that disappointing, or I think that that weakens the novel. You know, his concerns in A Hologram for the King were utterly topical. The little thing on the back of the book begins, in Saudi Arabia, far from weary, recession-scarred America. You know, and that alone sets the stage. It's an extremely loaded way to begin a book, to invite a reader to look at your book, because you know already that it's going to not be at all far from weary, recession-scarred America, because he qualified Saudi Arabia as far from weary, recession-scarred America, which is a stupid way to qualify a place like Saudi Arabia. But he's put in Saudi Arabia in relation to the United States, and that's the only way he's really characterizing it. And that would be one of my, biggest complaints. Like, say I was somebody who actually really cared a lot about a place like, let's say, Saudi Arabia, and had picked up the book thinking, I would like to hear about Saudi Arabia. I would certainly be disappointed, because it's not at all about Saudi Arabia. The only things about Saudi Arabia are these sort of off-the-cuff, totally, totally cutaneous details about Saudi Arabian life or whatever that you might expect to read in the beginning of a travel guide. There was nothing with any sort of real perceptive power, or nothing really even that interesting. Dave Eggers' whole concern was he wanted, clearly, to write a book that bitched and moaned about things that are certainly valid things to bitch and moan about, but that don't add together to make a successful novel. Does that make any sense to you?
I haven't read the novel, but,
it's like weighted down by its own topicality, if that's a word. You know, the main character, Alan Clay, I can't believe I remember his stupid name, he sympathized with him at first because he's like Joe Everyman, failed businessman who, you know, lost everything in the recession, blah, blah, blah. I heard the whole novel in the tone of voice like this, as if I was on NPR. You know, very breathy, very melodramatic, very sentimental, and it's like, stop being so serious, you know? It's not at all fun to listen to somebody's problems for 300 pages, and even less so when you don't even care about the person. I said in the review, Dave Eggers could have written a pretty good op-ed in, let's say, the New York Times, about the issues that led up to the recession and that have resulted from the recession, and he could have used all the examples he used in the book, and it would have been maybe 20 double-spaced pages. But instead, he stretched it out to novel length, and added some characters I don't care about, and some plot points that were next to totally uncompelling, and the end result is something that's going to sell a million copies, and that he published himself with his own publishing house. Great.
It says in your contributor bio for Diagram that you are currently waiting tables. That's hard, fast-paced work. Do you find you get more ideas for your writing during your free time, or when you're on the job?
Much of my novel is about life in the service industry, which I think is a fascinating place. I have had jobs in the service industry, everything from washing dishes to bartending to waiting tables to being a busboy for years to... I've done most of the jobs you can, and I've had those jobs continuously since I was, I think, 15 or something. It's a really, really interesting place full of very interesting people. And, yeah, coming to terms with life and work in the service industry is one of my big concerns. Do I get ideas for stories and things while I'm actually working? No, at least when I'm waiting tables, I spend most of my time putting on a happy face. But lots of times I'll talk to somebody who's, let's say, a total... and then I will think I should write a story about this. Or I'll say something that's sort of heartbreaking, you know, no more than in anybody's life, you know, or sitting on the subway watching people be people and sympathetic and endearing and totally unsympathetic and horrible ways. And that's why people are really interesting. This region also is full of people with drug problems, which I think sort of spices things up, because drug problems, I think, are interesting. Same thing with alcoholism.
Drugs and sex catch my attention, which is something commendable about your story, thinking back. I don't think there was sex in it until the very end. I don't know, usually sex is what keeps my attention as I'm going through a story, but it wasn't really needed for your story to keep my attention, so kudos.
You want the 11-year-old in the story to be having sex, Nicholas? You pervert?
No, not at all.
Sure, now you're fact-tracking.
Yeah, I set myself up, huh?
For the story, sex was not part of the story. I mean, I certainly don't think it loses anything, and it's not because I'm averse to talking about sex. If you read my novel, if I ever get it published, there's certainly sex in there. But my fiction professor, Alex G., said that you should only have a sex scene if you learn something in it, which I think is generally true of any real scene in a novel or a story or anything. It has to be there for a reason, otherwise it is literally gratuitous, and the reader picks up on that, and that is bad.
It actually brings us back to Jonathan Franzen, which you may not have expected. I had the pleasure of interviewing Jonathan Franzen, and so I was reading all these interviews, and one of them, he said this thing about how his writer friend told him, after he showed his writer friend his manuscript, that he needed more sex. You know, a story has to have so much sex to keep the reader interested. And I agreed with that at the time, and that's where my comment on the sex came from, which I thought you might find interesting, given your stance on Farther Away.
That must have offended Jonathan Franzen's sensibilities. The thing about Jonathan Franzen, and I feel comfortable talking about this because lots of Farther Away is essays where he literally confesses these things about himself. But he basically doesn't really like other people, or for instance, at all. And so a lot of his writing is full of fantasies about being separated from other people. That's totally unsympathetic and not something that I find compelling. I mean, other people may be able to sympathize with that, and sure, being solitary is sometimes soothing, whatever. But that's why I found it next to impossible to sympathize with, for instance, Walter Berglund, who, it turns out, is actually really just a mouthpiece for Franzen's opinion. This whole thing about just wanting to be in nature, to photograph things, and sort of be natural. Franzen's sort of revulsion at the prospect of being close to other people is most insanely expressed in his obsession with getting people to not reproduce. He's got this insane fantasy that the world is getting more and more jam-packed by people at every place. There's always more people who are always taking away his little, you know, pastoral scenes of, you know, sparrows alighting on his nose and whistling songs at him. It's utterly nuts and embarrassing. I really couldn't find it in me to sympathize with something like that.
Okay, here's a question. I hope I'm the first and the last interviewer to ask you this. Is Woody Brown a pen name?
Do you think it's a pen name?
No, I don't.
Don't you? What do you think my name is?
No, I don't think it's a pen name. I think your name is Woody Brown.
My name is Woodrow Brown, Woodrow David Brown. I've been called Woody my whole life, although some people call me Woodrow, some people call me Wood, some people call me Dro. I go by Woody because that's one of my names. People tell me, you know what, people actually tell me this way more often than I'd like when they see my stuff in Hard Boys or something. Hey, Woody, you should go by Woodrow. Woodrow's such like strong American name. That's like a writer's name. And it's like, what the fuck is that supposed to mean? Is Woody not sweet enough?
Poop or a wooden... Those are the two things I see when I hear Woody Brown. Well, no, in the future, all I'm going to think about is fine literature, but at first, those are the images that came to mind, because it's kind of a poetic and descriptive name. I mean, yeah, there's two descriptive words that make up your name.
Yeah, in a certain way. I mean, those two perceptions of yours put you in the distinguished company of every other third grade bully I ever had. But I'm glad that my name could be a vaguely sexual seeming or fecal Rorschach blot by which you could examine the manifestations of your own unconscious, Mr. Wilsey.
Thank you, Woody. And it's been really great to have you, so thank you for talking with us today.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.